Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from SIRI, an Alaska Native corporation with operations and investments spanning 5 continents, 45 states, and 2 U.S. territories.
Well, we made some progress, but it's not very transparent what the progress is the unfortunate thing.
More than a year after voters approved them, Anchorage police still don't have body cameras. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, August 23rd. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, Governor Mike Dunleavy says Alaska is the best place to mine for critical minerals.
If you care about enriching people and not dictators, you need to produce resources here in Alaska.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Alaska Pacific University offers degree-seeking students the opportunity to receive donor-funded scholarships, grants, and other financial aid. Apply for admission to be automatically considered for most scholarships. Complete financial aid applications by priority deadlines to receive optimal consideration. Financial aid counselors are available to assist. Learn more at alaskapacific.edu. This message sponsored by Alaska Pacific University.
U.S. House candidate Tara Sweeney is bowing out of the race for the next full congressional term and giving up her spot on the November ballot, likely to a Libertarian candidate. Alaska Public Media's Liz Ruskin reports.
Sweeney is a moderate Republican who came out in favor of abortion rights. She's a former executive at Arctic Slope Regional Corporation and was Assistant Interior Secretary for Indian Affairs in the Trump administration. She had substantial financial support from Alaska Native corporations and their affiliates. But in an emailed news release Tuesday afternoon, Sweeney says she saw no path to victory. She did not endorse another candidate. In the regular primary on August 16, Sweeney finished fourth. She got 4% of the vote with a majority of ballots counted. That would get her a spot on the November ballot, but she was well behind the frontrunners, Mary Peltola, Sarah Palin, and Nick Begich. Instead, her spot will go to the likely fifth-place finisher, Libertarian Chris Bye. The Division of Elections says that because Sweeney left the race with more than 64 days until the next election, the fifth-place finisher can move up. Sweeney's campaign raised about $300,000. A separate political action committee called Alaskans for Tara raised more than $600,000 to promote her. Reporting from Anchorage, I'm Liz Ruskin.
And a quick note, Tara Sweeney dropped out of the regular election for a full House term. We're still waiting to see who will win the special election to serve in Congress for the rest of the year. This afternoon, the Division of Elections released an update. With an additional 2,400 votes counted, Democrat Mary Peltola slightly increased her lead over Republican Sarah Palin, while Republican Nick Begich remains in third. The winner won't be determined until the end of the month. Well, the Alaska Black Caucus and other advocacy groups say they're considering legal action over the Anchorage Police Department still not having body cameras more than 16 months after voters approved buying them. The groups decried the lack of body cameras on officers and the lack of a body camera policy in a letter they sent Monday to Police Chief Michael Curl, Mayor Dave Bronson, and Anchorage Assembly Chair Suzanne LaFrance. Rich Kirtner is Justice Co-Chair with the Alaska Black Caucus. He says when the cameras were approved by voters last April, then-Chief Ken McCoy had organized several community meetings on the policy, and progress was coming together quickly.
And so we were really moving, and then all of a sudden, Chief McCoy left, and it kind of we've stalled out since then. We made some progress, but it's not very transparent what the progress is the unfortunate thing.
In the letter, advocates say they want a firm timeline from the city for moving forward on body cameras. Kirtner says the groups will consider legal action if a timeline isn't presented by mid-September.
A lot of times you can ask, and you might not even get an answer, but many times when a judge asks somebody to what's going on, then you'll get an answer from the judge has a lot more power than we do.
He says he also hopes the city's body camera policy includes a clear pathway for the public to get access to the footage beyond the sometimes lengthy public records request process. In the letter, the groups highlighted a Department of Justice statistic that over 80% of police departments in the country already have body cameras on officers. Jeremy Conkling is the head of the Anchorage Police Union, APDEA. He says there have been two negotiation sessions between the union, the police department, and the Bronson administration about the policy. He says a big sticking point for the union is allowing officers to review footage.
Prior to making a statement, prior to writing police reports, prior to, you know, going to court to testify as a witness, so that the what the officer then reports is the most accurate and thorough representation of what they saw and perceived and heard on that call.
Conkling says the union supports having body cameras, and while he's frustrated with how long the process has taken, he'd like the policy to be thorough. A spokeswoman for the Anchorage Police Department said she didn't have a timeline for when the body cameras will be implemented and declined to comment on the policy. Conkling says the police union, city officials, and the police department are expected to go into a third negotiation session tomorrow. Governor Mike Dunleavy is championing Alaska as the most responsible place to develop critical minerals and rare earth elements for renewable energy and other technology. The governor pushed the message today during an address at a pro-mining critical minerals summit at the University of Alaska Fairbanks.
If you care about the environment, you need to produce resources in Alaska. If you care about social justice, we need to produce resources here in Alaska. If you care about enriching people and not dictators, we need to produce resources here in Alaska.
Governor Dunleavy touted Alaska as a place with environmental, social, and governance, or ESG, standards.
There's a lot of talk about ESG nowadays, but Alaska has been doing ESG before ESG was a thing.
Dunleavy welcomed President Biden invoking the Defense Production Act to increase U.S. output of critical minerals, including lithium, cobalt, manganese, graphite, and nickel, but criticized the administration for halting Alaska's Ambler Industrial Access Road. A woman has died in state corrections custody while facing assault charges, the Alaska Department of Corrections said today. 35-year-old Natasha Minuk was pronounced dead this morning at the Highland Mountain Correctional Center in Eagle River, according to a statement from the department. She had been in jail one day, the agency said. Minuk is the third person to die in department custody this month. No foul play is suspected, according to the statement. A cause of death was not provided. Earlier this month, the department reported the deaths of 34-year-old Austin Earl Wilson and 62-year-old David Eric Bristow at the Anchorage Correctional Complex. The department said neither of those deaths were COVID-related. 9 people have died in the department's custody this year. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the end of the federal free lunch program is leaving some parents confused.
You have to be able to have a calm stomach if you're going to learn. And so that's a fundamental function that our schools serve these days.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
NEA Alaska is a professional education association representing over 11,000 of Alaska's dedicated public school employees. Their members are united in their commitment to provide an excellent education for every student, regardless of background or zip code. Together, NEA Alaska members work with colleagues, parents, and their communities to build strong public schools that are productive, safe, and welcoming to all. Learn more at neaalaska.org. This message sponsored by NEA Alaska.
State fishery managers will continue to keep the Kuskokwim River closed to coho salmon fishing. With the run the lowest it's been in decades and unlikely to meet state escapement goals, managers have refused local residents' requests to loosen restrictions. KYUK's Anna Rose MacArthur reports.
Last week, for the first time ever, the State Department of Fish and Game closed the entire Kuskokwim River and nearly all tributaries to coho salmon fishing and to gill nets. Coho had just started reaching the upper waters, and residents say the closure disproportionately limits the ability of upper river communities to access this critical protein source. Hours after the closure took effect, a group of local subsistence users who advised the state on salmon management asked the state to open the upper Kuskokwim River full-time to coho salmon fishing, and they asked the state to open the lower river to 4-inch mesh set gill nets 3 days per week for whitefish harvest. But in a letter issued on Friday, 2 days after the closure took effect, state fishery manager Nick Smith said that he could not fulfill these requests. He acknowledged that the closure is creating severe hardships, but calls it necessary, so there will be enough coho for subsistence harvest in the future. He cited state data from the Bethel test fishery indicating the river is experiencing its lowest coho run in 23 years. Meanwhile, the state is reporting the lowest ever recorded escapement at the Gweethluk River and escapements below their long-term averages at the Karagaluk and George River weirs. With coho showing no indication of meeting state escapement goals, Smith says opening the river would not just be contrary to state statute and regulation, but also to fundamental principles of sustainable salmon fisheries management. He said that if coho numbers increase enough to meet escapement goals, then fishing restrictions will loosen. In Bethel, I'm Anna Rose MacArthur.
Meanwhile, fish counting has wrapped for the sockeye runs on the Kenai and Kisilof rivers this summer. The Late Kenai River could fall within the escapement goals set by the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. Over 1.5 million sockeye passed through the sonar on the river during the late run. But the Kisilof River run of over 970,000 sockeye will far exceed its goalposts and is a record for the run, says Brian Marston, area manager for Upper Cook Inlet Commercial Fisheries.
Well, this, you know, it's considerably above our escapement goal. The upper end of our escapement goal is 320,000.
Marston says it's not that the run itself was bigger than usual. It's that there wasn't as much commercial fishing taking place to harvest that salmon.
The high escapements are at least partially due to lack of harvest effort in the east side set net fishery.
Set netters on the east side of Cook Inlet were cut off early this year with their fishery closing in mid-July amid low king salmon counts. That's when the sockeye run on the Kisilof surged and hit daily records. Marston says he does have some concerns about the impact of high escapement on the future of the fishery. That's in part because the higher density a fish population gets, the more competition there is for food among rearing fish.
And certainly when you go over the goal, it increases the possibility that you'll get lower yields in the future. And we have gone significantly over for 3 years in a row now in Kisilof. So looks like we could have some lower yields in the future. We just don't know what that'll be or when.
He says his department won't know for several seasons how severe of an impact those numbers will have on the run. President Joe Biden signed the Democrats' tax and climate package, known as the Inflation Reduction Act, into law last week. Among the law's key provisions are a $7,500 tax credit for new electric vehicles, but only if the cobalt, graphite, and other minerals in the EV's batteries come from domestic or friendly sources. And as KRBD's Eric Stone reports, that provision and others in the bill could spur mine development in Alaska.
The Inflation Reduction Act offers $7,500 tax credits for people who buy new electric vehicles. But as Patty Ryan of the Atlanta Council's Global Energy Center explains, there's a pretty big catch.
There are about zero cars on the U.S. market today that could potentially qualify for these credits.
That's because starting in 2024, 40% of the metals used in electric vehicle battery production, including cobalt, manganese, nickel, lithium, and graphite, have to either be extracted or processed in the U.S. or a friendly country to qualify for the credit. That figure moves to 80% by 2027. And none can come from so-called foreign entities of concern. That's diplomat ease for China and Russia.
So essentially, the supply chain implications are the real story.
Most of the lithium used in the lithium-ion batteries that go into EVs comes from Australia and Chile, says economist Brett Watson at the University of Alaska Anchorage's Institute of Social and Economic Research.
So those will qualify under the tax credit provisions, which require sourcing materials from nations that have a free trade agreement with the United States, with both of those nations do.
But that's not the case for some of the other minerals used in batteries.
Cobalt, on the other hand, is mostly sourced from the Democratic Republic of the Congo.
The U.S. doesn't have a free trade agreement with the Congo, and that means EV manufacturers will have to source their cobalt elsewhere, maybe from recycling, or maybe from Alaska.
Cobalt is being prospected right now from the Ambler District.
That's a mining prospect in northwest Alaska. Whether it'll turn into a mine is far from a sure bet. The project has been mired in controversy for years. But the company hoping to develop the Ambler Mining District sees the Inflation Reduction Act as an encouraging sign, and not just because of the tax credits for cobalt. Ambler Metals president and CEO Ramzi Fawaz says the Inflation Reduction Act's tax credits for advanced manufacturing are more important to his project in the short term.
And what it boils down to is the companies that are in mining, and they can write off 10% of the cost of their operations if they produce one single critical mineral.
There's a long list of minerals that qualify, from aluminum to zinc.
Our first project will be called the Arctic Project. And once we make a decision to invest and start construction, the mine will operate and mainly produce copper and zinc and other metals sometime in the late 20s.
Cobalt production from the so-called bornite deposit would start much later. But will the Inflation Reduction Act's tax credits be enough to move the needle towards actually getting a mine built?
It's a complex question, of course, because it does help for sure. But there are so many factors in realizing a project like ours.
Like, for example, whether a planned 200-plus mile road to the mining district will move forward. The state's investment agency has poured millions into efforts to build the road, but the project stalled in February after the Biden administration said an environmental analysis of the road was flawed. The push for more domestic minerals to support green technology could have far-reaching effects all over the state. Watson, the economist, points to a prospect called Graphite One outside Nome as another potential beneficiary of the Inflation Reduction Act's electric vehicle tax credit. And in Southeast, he says the advanced manufacturing credit could make development of a rare earth mine on Prince of Wales Island and a processing facility planned for the Ketchikan area an easier sell.
You could imagine that facility in Ketchikan applying for that advanced manufacturing tax credit. So there's something in the bill potentially for the Ketchikan Boken Ridge facility as well.
But Watson says what would truly move the needle is a bill that would reform the sometimes decades-long permitting process to get the mines built. That's reportedly part of the deal that created the Inflation Reduction Act, but no bill has been filed in Congress yet. Reporting in Ketchikan, I'm Eric Stone.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, celebrating 45 years of Alaska operations. Learn more at alyeskapipeline.com. Everyone knows eating fruits and veggies promotes a long and healthy life. It's important to make every bite count. Alaskans are lucky to have greens and berries from the land, as well as fresh, frozen, and canned. When it comes to living a long and healthy life, remember, every bite counts. This message sponsored by USDA SNAP Ed.
The end of a two-year federal free school lunch program is causing confusion and stress among students and parents in the Kenai Peninsula Borough School District. Free and reduced lunch is still available at district schools, but the transition back from the universal free lunch program hasn't been without its challenges. District officials are reminding parents that free and reduced fee lunches are still available to families with certain income restraints. KDLL's Riley Board has the story.
Before the pandemic, students who fell into certain income categories were eligible for free and reduced lunch at school. But over the past 2 years, COVID-19 relief money from the United States Department of Agriculture has supported free lunches for all students at the district schools. According to Kevin Lyon, Director of Planning and Operations for the district, that means schools haven't collected any money from students for food in 2 years. He explained while the program was running, the district provided somewhere around 6,000 free meals a day. He said at some schools, that meant every single student was taking advantage of the free lunches.
We were serving a lot of kids. We served a lot of meals.
Over the summer, that program came to an end. At that time, the district announced the end of the Universal Free Lunch Program and encouraged parents to fill out an online application to request free or reduced lunch if they qualified for it. But word didn't make it to everyone in the district. Recent posts on Facebook falsely suggested it was the district that had removed the free lunch program, not the federal government, and community members chided the district for their failure to support the students. Nathan Erfurth, president of the local teachers union, says he first heard about the issue when he got an email from his kindergartner's school.
The school sent out an email notifying parents that 60 students at the school were not prepared to have lunch today. Therefore, you need to get your pay accounts funded. You need to make sure that you've got your free and reduced lunch paperwork completed. That takes time to process, or else kids will have to be denied lunch. I thought that was quite a large number of students.
After several schools sent out similar announcements, Erfurth says he saw pushback and confusion from parents and school employees on social media. He says the miscommunication comes down to a couple of key factors. One was confusion over the application timeline for the lunch program.
Typically, parents who are on the free and reduced lunch program have a month between when school starts, roughly a month between when school starts and when their last year's application expires. So that means that there's a couple of weeks where they've got their kids in school and the school can remind them, you need to fill out this form.
However, because the Universal Free Lunch Program has been in place for the past 2 years, Erfurth says no such rollover grace period existed. Erfurth says the second issue is that the district has moved to a new, entirely online application for free and reduced lunch. He says in past years, that application went home in an introductory packet to parents at the beginning of the year. This year, the form was not included in the packet. Erfurth says he was struck by the fact that students are only allowed to charge, that is, incur debt for lunch, for up to 2 days of meals. On top of that, students are only allowed to do these charges if their parents have filled out an opt-in form in advance. Students cannot charge any further meals until the amount is paid back.
We know food is at the bottom of Maslow's hierarchy. Everyone has to eat to be able to do anything beyond that. You have to be able to have a calm stomach if you're going to learn. And so that's a fundamental function that our schools serve these days.
Lyon says the charge policy exists so parents know how many meals their students are getting from the school. The district also offers an option where parents can be notified if their students' balance drops to a certain low level.
We've got all kinds of things that we do to make sure the kids are fed, because if the kids are fed, then they do better in school. But we also want to work with their parents so that they're able to be in charge of what their child does. We don't want them charging up a bill that mom and dad didn't even know about.
Lyon explains that, to allow parents to readjust to the old school nutrition system, the credit option has been extended until September 6th. He says that the schools have sent out notices to parents after many students showed up to school on the first day expecting lunch to be free. The free and reduced lunch application can be filled out at any point in the year. This year, for students approved for free and reduced meals, breakfast will be free and lunch will be 40 cents. In Kenai, I'm Riley Board.
A humpback whale calf appears to be okay after an encounter with a tour boat near Juneau. The collision left some of the whale's skin on the boat's hull. Susie Tierlink is a coordinator for the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's Whale Sense program. She saw video of the incident.
The whale certainly felt that contact, probably didn't feel good.
The calf's name is Cinder. Cinder is about 6 months old and 18 to 20 feet long. Its mother is Flame, a Juneau regular that Tierlink describes as a, quote, supermother. Flame has brought four calves back to Juneau in 4 years, when a calf every 2 or 3 years is typical. But Tierlink says this latest calf is a little too interested in people.
We've been getting reports about it being very curious and coming up to boats and being interested in the boat and the passengers, spy hopping, weaving underneath the boat, blowing bubbles, that kind of a thing.
Tierlink says video of the August 11th incident shows the calf rolling against the boat, which was idling. Since then, NOAA researchers have seen Cinder out and about and acting normally. But Tierlink is concerned about the consequences of the behavior to the calf and to anyone who encounters it.
I was really trying to emphasize, these are huge animals, and even just a small interaction could be really harmful to anyone involved.
Tierlink says this kind of curiosity isn't super rare in whale calves, but encountering curious whales calls for more caution and for giving such whales as much space as possible.
I I don't want people rushing out there trying to have that experience.
Tierlink says it's best to stay 100 yards away from whales and to idle if a whale comes closer. And with curious whales like Cinder, it might be a good idea to think of a way to start backing away safely. Well, earlier this month, Dillingham's annual Mud Run, an outdoor event for kids to get active, returned after a two-year hiatus. KDLG's Catherine Moncure has the story.
On a sunny afternoon in Dillingham, a series of large wooden trays filled with mud line the gravel path by the softball field. It's the Mud Run, an obstacle course organized by the Bristol Bay Area Health Corporation. The Mud Run is back after a two-year COVID-19 hiatus. It's an opportunity for kids and some adults to get outside, get active, and get, well, muddy. A giant inflatable arch marks the start of the course. In true Bristol Bay fashion, the theme of the Mud Run is salmon. Volunteer and participant Deanna Beyer describes the setup.
So we've got different stations where the participants essentially are salmon and they're going through or under a gill net. They're going past bears. They're going up a fish ladder or waterfalls.
Kids hop over logs and wriggle through the mud, trying not to get caught in the net. The bears are high schoolers on the cross-country team, pelting the younger children with water balloons. Then they get doused in bright color powder as they run back toward the starting line. The mud that everyone is crawling, jumping, and splashing through came from Kinnacknack Beach. The Dillingham cross-country coach volunteered her team to set up the course, so the group of runners hauled the cold mud from one side of town to the other.
So we brought some a few totes, some people, and some shovels, and we kind of like put them in a certain way so we can just drag all the dirt into the totes.
That's Mud Run participant Dylan McCambly. He explains the scientific process of how they created the perfect batch of mud.
And then we brought them here, put them in the tarps, and just put some water on them, and eventually with some mixing, it turned into some mud.
Not everyone is as comfortable with the mud as Dylan is. Cross-country coach Amanda Leaton has brought her 5-year-old daughter, Leah, to the Mud Run, too. When asked if she enjoyed the race, she has mixed feelings.
Yeah, but I didn't like that it squished in my shoes.
Leah's mom asks her to elaborate.
Did the mud feel good?
Yeah, but I know.
No. No, is it because your shoes kept falling off?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry. Do you want to do it again next year?
But it's so muddy, too muddy.
What if we had boots on?
Perfect.
Perfect.
In Dillingham, I'm Catherine Moncure.
That's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin and Wesley Early in Anchorage, Anna Rose MacArthur in Bethel, Eric Stone in Ketchikan, Riley Board in Kenai, Yvonne Crumry in Juneau, and Catherine Moncure in Dillingham. If you want to send us a news tip, question, or comment, email us at news@alaskapublic.org. Our audio engineer is Tobin Shelby, Katie Anastas is our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com.
Planning today for a gift down the road builds a legacy of support for the media you treasure. Thank you for considering this public radio station in your estate planning. You can talk to your financial advisor or contact your public radio station to learn more. Thank you. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.